Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Brian Paul. I'm a partner at Ice Miller and the president of the Indianapolis Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. On June 19 of this year, the New York Times Sunday edition ran a front-page story by reporter Mike McIntyre called The Justice and the Magnate. The story tells of the friendship between Justice Thomas, who is a native of Pinpoint, Georgia, and a real estate mogul named Harlan Crow, who is financing the construction of a museum dedicated to the culture and history of Pinpoint. Now, why, might you ask, would this be worthy of a front-page story in the New York Times Sunday edition? Is this really all the news that's fit to print? The deeper you dig, the more you are apt to wonder what the Times is up to. The museum, after all, is not about Justice Thomas, and in all events, there's no evidence whatsoever that Justice Thomas strong-armed Mr. Crow into backing the museum, or even really that he asked Mr. Crow for money on behalf of the museum. Not even the Times claimed this, though it did insinuate it. But the newspaper was quick to point out, if Thomas had solicited Mr. Crow to contribute to this philanthropic cause, it might possibly, arguably, potentially, violate the Federal Code of Judicial Ethics, a code that, alas, the Times lamented does not bind the Supreme Court. No, the real problem, it seems, is that Justice Thomas has a conservative judicial philosophy, that Justice Thomas's wife has a conservative political philosophy, and that Mr. Crow, who is friends with both of the Thomases, is a contributor to conservative causes. According to the Times, Supreme Court ethics have been under increasing scrutiny, largely because of the activities of Justice Thomas and Ms. Thomas, whose group, Liberty Central, opposed President Obama's health care overhaul, an issue likely to wind up before the court. The gall. Apparently, spouses of Supreme Court justices are supposed to seal themselves off from the public debate over weighty issues, particularly if those issues stand any chance of ending up before the court, which in the modern era of Supreme Court review pretty much includes every weighty issue of our day, and especially if the spouse is conservative. The solution to this problem, the Times said in a recent op-ed, is for the Supreme Court to adopt a strict code of ethics for itself, which would provide for a review process by a committee of justices to ensure accountability. I'm not inclined to reject an idea simply because it's supported by the New York Times. But when the Times tells us, as it has, that former Representative Anthony Weiner was working on a bill to address the issue of Supreme Court ethics before his resignation, it is fair to say that I am skeptical of the Times proposal. Here to give his own op-ed on the subject is Brian Fitzpatrick. Brian is a Notre Dame alum, a Harvard Law grad, and a former Supreme Court clerk. Currently, he is an associate professor at Vanderbilt University Law School, which happens to be my alma mater. And the title today of his talk is The Extrajudicial Activities of Supreme Court Justices: Is Reform Needed? Please welcome Brian Fitzpatrick.
Thank you all for having me here today. This is a great turnout. This is a very active chapter, and I'm very happy to be here to talk about some of the recent controversies, not just those that Brian referred to. There are many others. The recent controversies involving the extrajudicial activity of Supreme Court justices and the calls to do something about it. What are these controversies? Well, in addition to the friendship that Justice Thomas has with someone who has some money to create a museum in Pinpoint, Georgia, there's also the fact that you may have recalled seeing that Justice Scalia recently in January of this year gave a seminar to new members of the House of Representatives on constitutional law. The seminar was organized by House members who self-affiliate with the Tea Party movement, although all House members were invited to attend the seminar, and many Democrats attended the seminar. But some people thought it was too political for Justice Scalia to be going over to the House of Representatives to talk to people in the Tea Party movement. Justice Alito gave a speech to a fundraising banquet for the American Spectator magazine. Some people thought that was too political. The American Spectator, you know, a conservative magazine, came to fame during the Clinton years with Paula Jones and the like. Then Justices Scalia and Thomas, it has been reported, attended some retreats in 2007 and 2008 that were organized by the Koch brothers and billed as these retreats were billed as political calls to action of sorts. And Scalia and Thomas were at the retreats for part of the weekend to give dinner talks that were organized by the Federalist Society in conjunction with this weekend. Some people thought that was not only too political, because the brothers are very active in donating to candidates and to advocating for changes in the political system, but people thought it also presented something of a conflict of interest because at the same time, or around the same time, the justices were at these events, the Supreme Court was considering the Citizens United case, which raised the question whether corporations could spend money on behalf of candidates. And some people thought that the Koch brothers would benefit from a particular disposition in that decision, and therefore was a conflict of interest for the justices to attend those retreats. As Brian mentioned, there's also been controversies around Justice Thomas's wife, who has her own career, and that career is a political one, and some people have said that it looks bad for Justice Thomas that his wife is involved in political causes. So earlier this year, a so-called public interest organization, Common Cause, asked the Department of Justice to investigate Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas's attendance at the Koch retreats and to file a motion under Rule 60 to reopen the Citizens United case and to ask that case to be vacated because the justices had a conflict of interest in the matter. They also added there's an independent reason why the case should be reopened. They asked the Attorney General to file this motion, they said, because Justice Thomas's wife stood to gain, her organization stood to gain financially from the Citizens United decision, because now that corporations can give more money, groups like hers can get more money from corporations. Therefore, Justice Thomas had a conflict of interest, and the case should be reopened and vacated. So a lot of people have pointed to these activities and said the Supreme Court has become too political. Their extrajudicial activities are causing too many conflicts of interest and too many appearances of impropriety. And because of that, some people want to reform legal institutions in order to crack down on the Supreme Court. Well, where do things stand right now in terms of the justices' legal obligations with regard to conflicts of interest and political activities? Well, their obligation right now is found in a federal statute, 28 U.S.C. 455, which requires any federal judge, lower court judge, or Supreme Court justice to recuse him or herself when his or her impartiality might reasonably be questioned. And at the Supreme Court, the justices get to decide for themselves when and whether they should recuse. There's no review of their decisions. So if they decide their impartiality might be questioned reasonably, then they can recuse. If they think that it cannot be questioned, then they don't have to. And no one can second-guess them on those decisions. Now, in light of all these controversies that I referred to, a lot of people think that Section 455 is inadequate to control the extrajudicial activities of the Supreme Court. And there are two problems that people have pointed to about Section 455. One is it's too vague. What does it mean that impartiality might be reasonably questioned? You know, a justice could drive a truck through that, some people think. That's the language so vague, you could escape falling under it in any manner of ways. And number two, as I said, there's no enforcement mechanism. The justices decide for themselves whether or not their recusal is required. So because of these two elements of dissatisfaction, some people have argued that we should change the law and do something about it. There have been no fewer than half a dozen New York Times editorials on this one subject over the last 6 months or so. And the people like Common Cause and the New York Times that want to change things have coalesced around three particular proposals that they would like to see accomplished. Number one, they want the Supreme Court's decisions about recusal to be more transparent. And so there's a letter that has been sent to Congress on behalf of 100 law professors. I'm not on it. 100 law professors have asked Congress to pass a statute that requires justices to explain their recusal decisions in writing. Number two, these reform-minded folks would like to elaborate on the legal obligations of the justices. So there is something currently out there, the Code of Conduct for United States Judges. It is binding on lower court judges, but not on the U.S. Supreme Court. The Code of Conduct for United States Judges is a more comprehensive code of ethics, like the Code of Conduct for lawyers. And this law professor letter, as well as the New York Times editorials, have asked Congress to enact a statute that applies the Code of Conduct to the Supreme Court justices as well as the lower court judges that are already obligated by it. The third reform proposal is to create a mechanism whereby violations of this code and the justices' recusal decisions can be reviewed by someone else. And so the law professors were kind of vague on this when they submitted their letter. They just said Congress create some sort of process to do it. They didn't say what the process should be. And as we'll see in a moment, it's kind of hard to figure out what the process would be. Now, in an unusual turn of events, someone listened to the law professors. And all of these recommendations have now found their way into legislation introduced in Congress. The bill that has been introduced by the now infamous Representative Wiener, along with Representative Murphy of Connecticut, H.R. 862, requires three things. Number one, when the justices choose to recuse or deny motions to recuse, they must explain their reasons in writing. Number two, the code of conduct will now apply to the justices. And number three, if someone makes a complaint against a Supreme Court justice under the code of conduct, it will be investigated by the Judicial Conference of the United States. That's a group of largely lower court judges. And the bill also says, Judicial Conference, you shall create a process whereby other justices or lower court judges, it's up to the Judicial Conference, will review decisions by the justices not to recuse when they've been asked to recuse. So all of the three things the professors have asked for have found their way into pending legislation. Now, I think all of this is terribly misguided, and I have some practical objections to this effort to bring the Supreme Court justices under the thumb of Congress and the lower court judges when it comes to their extrajudicial activities. I have some practical objections, but I also have some more fundamental objections. The practical objections are I think these efforts are entirely partisan, I think they're entirely impractical, and I think they'd be entirely ineffective. The fundamental objections are that by historical standards, the things that people are complaining about are child's play to the extrajudicial activities that Supreme Court justices have engaged in. And we have to ask ourselves, what has changed? What has changed? I don't think we have changed. I don't think the justices have changed. What I think has changed is there's a desire by some people to protect the American people from the truth about what their judges are doing to them in this country, and in doing so to protect themselves. But I'm going to get to that at the end. I first want to start with some practical objections I have to these efforts. Number one, these efforts are entirely partisan. Where was Common Cause, where was the New York Times, and where were Congressmen Murphy and Wiener when Justices Ginsburg and Justices Stevens attended retreats hosted by George Soros that were not unlike the very retreats that they complain about Justices Thomas and Scalia attending, hosted by the Koch brothers? Where were these folks when Justice Ginsburg not unlike, if not worse, than Justice Alito attending the American Spectator dinner, a nonprofit organization, American Spectator, nonpartisan nonprofit organization. Where were they when Justice Ginsburg allowed the National Organization of Women to create an annual lectureship in her name? And where were they when she attended those lectures and introduced the speakers at those lectures? The National Organization of Women, unlike the American Spectator magazine, is a frequent litigant before the United States Supreme Court. Where were they when these things happened? They weren't there because I believe that a lot of these people that are advocating reform are less interested in reform than they are in scoring political points and trying to delegitimize the conservative Supreme Court justices. Number two, these proposals are wholly impractical. How can lower court judges or even other Supreme Court justices review the conduct of a Supreme Court justice? Let's start with the lower court judges. Doesn't that get something backwards to have lower court judges sitting in judgment of the decisions made by Supreme Court justices? That would kind of turn things on its head. I just can't believe anyone can take seriously the notion that we should reverse the hierarchy that we've created in this country and put those who are supposed to be subordinate to the Supreme Court, in fact, as their masters. Even the question of an equal reviewing these decisions, one of the other justices or a committee of other justices reviewing these decisions, strikes me as unworkable. I think it would create terrible dynamics and undermine collegiality of the court to ask your peers on the court to second-guess the decisions you've made about recusal. I think it would put people in an impossible position. For one thing, I don't think the other justices would want that kind of responsibility. I don't think they'd want to risk upsetting their colleagues by sitting in judgment of their recusal decisions. And I think they'd frankly be very reluctant to exercise any kind of authority they had there because I think they feel like it would be awkward to continue on in that kind of light. And so I just think it's entirely impractical to ask lower court judges or even other justices to review these decisions. And then finally, as a practical matter, I think it would be entirely ineffective to do this because the Code of Judicial Conduct is just as vague as Section 455 is about what the ethical limits of conduct for judges is. It is not clear that anything Justices Scalia, Thomas, or Alito did violate the Code of Conduct. The Code of Conduct does prohibit certain political activities by the justices, but the Code defines political activity very narrowly as activities for political parties, activities for or against political candidates, candidates running for office. There is a provision in there that defines political activity as activities by organizations or for organizations principally committed to advocating for candidates or parties. Maybe you could stretch the Soros and Koch events to be of that ilk, but I think it would be a real stretch. With regard to Justice Alito and Justice Ginsburg lectureships, the code permits judges to fundraise for nonprofit organizations. That's explicitly permitted in the code. And so, benefit dinners and the likes are okay. So in many ways, this is a much ado about nothing. The solution that has been proposed to the so-called problem wouldn't change anything, in my view. But those are just practical objections. I think there is a more sinister motive behind these reforms than all that. And I think the motive is a paternalistic one to protect the American people from some very important knowledge that some people don't want them to have. And I say that because if you look over the course of American history, what the Supreme Court justices are doing these days pales in comparison to the political activity they've done in the past. So just to give you some examples from the very early Republic, Chief Justice John Jay ran for governor of New York twice, in 1792 and 1795, while he was on the U.S. Supreme Court. Justice Cushing ran for governor of Massachusetts while he was serving on the United States Supreme Court. Justice Thompson allowed his name to be used as a candidate for president in 1824 and he later campaigned for governor of New York in 1828, all while on the court. The justices were quite involved in the 1800 election. Justices Chase and Washington made speeches for John Adams and Charles Pinckney. Chief Justice Ellsworth wrote scathing criticisms of Thomas Jefferson during his campaigns. He said if Jefferson were elected, he would be an enemy to whatever would encourage commercial enterprise or give enemy to the government. Our character would sink and our weakness would invite contempt and insult. Justice Patterson wrote a series of 46 newspaper essays that addressed a wide range of political issues, including a defense of the Jay Treaty and calls for reform of state election laws. Justice Story was famous for bitterly condemning slavery at town hall meetings while he was on the court. The list could go on and on and on. Going to a retreat, going to a fundraising dinner for a magazine, being married to someone who has her own career, pales in comparison to the activities that justices have done in the past and have done in the past without anyone thinking, or at least anyone that wasn't thinking it for partisan reasons, that what they did was beyond the pale. So what has changed since the founding era when it comes to the political activity of the justices? I don't think we, the American people, have changed. I don't think the judges have changed. What I think has changed is there's a desire by some people to hide the truth about what judges do from the American people. And there was an op-ed that was published recently in the New York Times by a former speechwriter for President Bill Clinton. His name is Jeff Schiessel, about all of this political activity that people are worried about. And what he said something very revealing in this op-ed. He said, quote, "We need to believe in Santa Claus a little bit, and these guys, the justices, aren't making it easy." What was he talking about? We need to believe in Santa Claus a little bit. What is Santa Claus here? Well, let me tell you what I think Santa Claus is and why I think he thinks that we need to believe in him. I think that he thinks Santa Claus is the notion that judges do not consult their own political views when they decide cases. I think that he thinks that it's true judges do, and as we know, all too many judges do. But I don't think he wants the American people to think that. I think he wants the American people to think that judges are just pulling books off the shelf, reading what they say, and then transcribing that in their opinions. I don't think he wants the American people to know what all of us know, that far too many judges, those that don't subscribe to originalist and textualist principles, those that subscribe to living Constitution principles, are consulting their own political views, their own worldviews, and writing those into the law. Now, why does he not want the American people to know what we all know about what judges do? Well, my view, my guess, my hypothesis is that I think he's worried. He's worried if the American people knew that a lot of judges were consulting their political views when they decided cases, then the American people would demand judges with different political views than they're getting now. Much of the living Constitution revolution that took place in this country over the last 60 years is unpopular with the American people. And if the American people knew it was just the value judgments of the justices that were behind those decisions, the American people would clamor for different justices. He's hoping that if we can pretend to the American people that it's all law and not politics up there, the American people won't try to change things from those politics that the elite on the left prefer into a politics that they do not prefer. I think this sort of paternalism, trying to protect the American people from the truth, getting them to believe in Santa Claus, I think that it is abominable. I think the American people can be trusted with the truth. I think they should know the truth, that all too often judges are consulting their political views. It's only if people know the truth, that they can, one, try to find judges that don't do that, and number two, if they can't, at least find judges that agree with them, as opposed to an elite on the left. Now, I don't think the world will end if the American people are told that judges are exercising their authority in accordance with their political views in many cases. I suspect the American people probably already know this. But I don't think the world would come to an end if they don't know that and were told it. Political scientists have done a number of studies over the past 10 years where they tried to gauge what people think about elected judges who tell voters while they're running for election what their views are on the various issues that might come before them when they take the bench. They give a preview to voters. If this kind of case comes up, my inclination is to say this is how I'd go on it. And the political scientists have asked voters, what do you think about judges that do this? What do you think about judges that say, I'm going to vote against gay marriage, let's say, and then 2 years later a case comes up and they vote against gay marriage? Do you think that's illegitimate? And the voters, the public, has said over and over and over again, no, that has zero impact. Whether the judge has taken a position beforehand on the issue has zero impact on whether the public sees their decisions as legitimate or not. Zero impact. And so I don't think the world will end if the American people knows what we all in this room know, that many, many judges are consulting their political views when they make decisions. And I think to deny that, to rest on paternalism, does not show much respect for the American people and will only insulate bad decisions and non-originalist judges from the scrutiny that I think they deserve. Thank you very much. I'm happy to take any questions that you might have.